Welcome to Master the Start, a podcast for young professionals where we interview business experts on how you can master the start of your life in business.
Hello, 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 ladies and germs. I hope your week is going incredibly well. Welcome back to the 27th episode of the Master the Start podcast, presented by GoMahi.com. We have a lovely episode ahead for you guys. Today, we have Dr. Joe G on the show. For more than 30 years, Dr. Joe, MD, has practiced medicine in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. He's a clinical professor at the University of Minnesota Cleft Palate Clinic School of Dentistry, and in the past, he was chief of surgery at Fairview Southdale Hospital in the Minneapolis suburb of Edina. He now has a private cosmetic surgery practice, has offices in Edina and Burnsville, Minnesota. In addition to being in private practice, Dr. G, or Dr. Joe, is a writer and international speaker. On top of all of that, he's a heck of a guy because Dr. Joe and his family have devoted themselves to helping people in third world countries. His time in Guatemala inspired his dedication to exceptional plastic surgery, and his experiences will be featured in his upcoming book. You can check it out. I believe it's coming out soon. Tentatively, it's titled Three Faces. This book will explore Dr. Joe's adventures with the Mayan Indians, as well as his medical journeys. It's going to be fascinating. I wish we would have had time to jump into it a little more in this episode, but he was hard pressed for time because he had to go do another procedure. So settle in, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, iHeart, or Google Play. Also, please comment on this episode. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you liked Dr. Joe or you'd like something a little more business heavy. Make sure you give us your feedback. Most importantly, enjoy this week's episode of Master the Start. All right, Dr. Joe, thanks for joining us on the show. We really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty excited to kind of get into your life story because it sounds really unique. Mm-hmm. Really, really unique. Okay. So if we could just start out with who's Dr. Joe? A little background, quick summary on your life, and then we'll kind of dive into the details.
Well, I don't know if you wanted to just summarize what I would stand for, be remembered for. It's helping kids in the third world with cleft lips and cleft palates. So when I was in college, I was in the seminary to be a priest, and then I was studying psychology, which is not real concrete. You know, it's about the opposite. You can get a surgery. And so I heard a talk about a mission in Guatemala. And so three of us guys decided, let's go down there. And so I went down to the mission, and there's all these people dying. I mean, the mortality rate of the kids in this town is 60% before the age of five. So if you have 10 kids, six are going to be dead on average before they reach kindergarten. And so it just was very impactful for me. And so I just changed my major from psychology to nursing, and then I went down there and lived for 6 months and worked as a nurse in the clinic in this church. And I saw all kinds of kids with cleft lips and cleft palates, and then the light went on. It's like, oh, I want to be a plastic surgeon. So I came back and got accepted to med school. Actually, I got accepted to med school. I was down there, and which was kind of difficult in a sense because you know how competitive it is to get into graduate school, whatever it is, you know. And my fiance at the time sent me a telegram and just said, you're in Minnesota. And this little guy comes by and rides by on his bicycle and puts a thumbtack on the door of the clinic. You're in Minnesota. Congrats. There's no phones, no wires, no Wi-Fi or any kind of internet way back then. So all it was the telegram. And I'm running around with the telegram in my hand. I'm in Minnesota. I'm in med school. Well, the people that I worked with were illiterate. They couldn't even read or write. So they didn't like get, you know, the hard work, the competition to beat out everybody to get into med school. And so they were just like, oh, okay, well, let's get back to work. And then that night I used to go out to mountain clinics. So I'd drive up to a different town up in the mountains every night. Usually these are called aldeas, and they're about 200 people. And then I would do stool specimens with the microscope and check them for TB and treat malnutrition, that kind of thing. And I bought the whole town beer that night. And I remember a couple of guys saying, what's the occasion? They go, oh, Jose's in med school. And they're like, oh, okay. Well, let's have a beer. I mean, I had nobody to share this with. So that was, you know.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So you were in Guatemala for 6 months at what age?
Would have been age 24.
And so why, what made you choose to go down there for 6 months?
Well, because when I heard the talk by the priest, and the three of us guys went down there, we stayed for about 3 weeks, and it just touched me. And I thought, you know what, a psychology major isn't going to be very helpful, and I really wanted to go back and help the people.
Hmm.
It's like, what are you going to do, fly back down there and go, oh, Mrs. Juarez, yeah, you look depressed today because your two kids just died, you know? It's like, that doesn't help. So I got a nursing degree instead of a psychology degree.
Definitely. That makes a lot of sense.
Dropped out of the seminary and then went back down, lived for 6 months, and then got accepted to med school. I was down there, and I'd already figured out I wanted to do cleft lips and palates down there.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
So you wanted to do cleft lips and palates down there. What made you do, I mean, you're doing plastics here in Minnesota. How do you balance the two things?
Well, Edina, I do boobs and butts, and then down, and then I go to South America every year and operate. So this year was my 35th year going down to South America. And that was in, we go every January now and go to Peru. We go up in the mountains in Peru. And we got a big team. I mean, there's like 20 people the first week and 20 people the second week. So it's a machine.
How many do you typically do in a day? How many procedures when you're down?
Four a day.
Four?
Yeah. And they're pretty big ones. I mean, some littler ones, but you know, a lip is maybe an hour and a half.
So you must have number one. I mean, now this is off script because now I'm just too curious. You must have some crazy stories from being down there. And they have to be, I'd assume, pretty moving. And that's why you go back every year.
Yeah. Really, the most moving story was... a mother brought her kid in who had a cleft lip, and I noticed the mother had a cleft lip too. And I said, well, I'm not going to fix your kid's lip unless you let me fix yours too. And she says, no, no, just my kid. So I just pushed her on it in my strongest Spanish and just said, you're having your lip done or I'm not doing your daughter. And she said, okay. So I did them both.
Wow. So how do you guys even pick how many people down there have cleft lips?
They come. It's really common. It's like here in the United States, it's about 1 in 700, and down there it's probably 1 in 150, depending on different areas. And that's all because the Asians have higher genetics for cleft lip. And so the Asians came across the Bering Straits, and then, you know, the Eskimos and North American, South American Indians. They've all got that genetic predisposition, and then of course they got malnutrition, inbreeding, and bad luck, you know. So they got lots of clefts.
So
but that was probably the most crazy sidekick story.
I bet. Seems very moving.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's 1 in 150 of these people that are dealing with this down there, I gotta imagine you just have a line full of people when you go down.
They're lined up ahead of time. They run the hospital, run clinics, and they'll put up billboards and put on radio ads, and people will come in that have, you know, we've done many people that are in their 20s and 30s that had a cleft lip their whole life. Their teeth are going sideways, and they can't talk. And
so how does it really work? Like, you basically give them a heads up that you're heading down, and then...
right. The program says they're heading down, and then they make appointments. And then the doctors in our group will make a final determination whether they're healthy enough for the surgery.
Mm. It's got to be very enlightening when you go from, do you primarily go to Guatemala or do you go?
Oh, we're going to Peru every year.
Peru?
So for the last 18 years, I've gone to Peru every year.
Okay.
Before then, for many years, I went to Ecuador. So they quit going to Guatemala, started going to Ecuador, and then now I'm going to Peru with a big group in St. Paul.
So why the change?
It's a big group and it's local people and other local plastic surgeons, so we all know each other. And I'm not going down with a group of strangers I've never met, which is cool too. I've done that many times, but this is, you know, a nice cohesive group.
How's surgery different when you do it down there versus here?
No, it's, you know, there's flies in the operating room and we got a fly swatter on the anesthesia stand, and the lights might go out in the middle of an operation. You're finishing with flashlights. The water will go on and off. There's no way to scrub your hands. All kinds of differences.
So do you use the materials they have there? Do you guys bring stuff down with you?
Yeah, we bring everything.
You bring everything?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Yeah, you can't... There's nothing.
So you're legitimately packing for all these surgeries beforehand?
Yeah, it's a big trip, right?
That just seems mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, it's a lot of logistics, huh?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I know you speak on ethics.
Yeah, I write a monthly column on ethics for both societies. I've been chair of the Judicial Council, and I've been on ethics for, like, the last 9 years, so yeah. So I got this, like, Dear Abby column, and it's Dear Dr. Joe, and then they ask these crazy ethics questions.
So could you give some examples? Like,
the guy down the block is raffling off breast implants. I thought that we couldn't give away surgery. So we've got, in our ethics code, it says you can't give away surgeries. You can't auction off of surgery. You can auction off, like, Botox, or you can auction off like a filler that you put in the face. So basically think of it this way. You can auction off anything that involves a needle, Botox, fillers, but you can't auction off anything that requires a scalpel. So if I wanted to auction off a facelift, that would go against our code of ethics because you got to cut the face.
Hmm.
And so this guy's off, he's auctioning off breast implants. And of course the person, the complainant, the person who turns in the surgeon, is always the same person. It's always the guy who's the competitor down the block. And he's real mad about the fact that his colleague is auctioning off breast implants because, you know, like the rain follows the thunder, the breast dog surgery follows the implants. You can't give them out to people anyway because it's a prescription item. So that'd be one example.
So within ethics of plastic surgery, because I don't know much about it. Mm-hmm. I really don't. Is there an age range in which, like, can you not conduct breast implants or something like that in someone younger than 18? Or how do ethics around age and individuals?
Yeah, ethics around age is difficult. I don't know if our code speaks to that. Basically, you know, people will do rhinoplasty on kids that are in their teens. I will. And then the parents sign. But by and large, for a medical device, I mean, I wouldn't do a breast dog for cosmetic reasons. You know, if a kid has a deformity or maldevelopment, that's different than, you know. But I would want to have the patient old enough that they could sign their own op permit.
Yeah.
But in terms of ethics, the things, you know, that's just a very quick list. Can I operate on my daughter? My daughter wants a rhinoplasty for graduating from college. Can I do that? That's a good ethics question. Egregious billing. Yeah, my doctor sewed up some tendons in my hand in the emergency room, charged $64,000. These are all real cases. Gee, I met a patient that I operated on 9 months ago at the gym, and we kind of hit it off. And, you know, what do you think? Can I go out with her? My answer was, there's more pretty girls in the world than one. And, you know, the law, basically their recommendations, you don't date a patient unless you haven't seen her for a year.
Hmm.
Yeah, all kinds of ones on... expert testimony where they're just giving false testimony and, you know, taking money. And that's the most common one is expert witness issues with ethics.
So what, you went through medical school, which means you had your great moments in time where you had to work really, really hard.
Mm-hmm.
What was the hardest part of medical school?
the basic science part. First 2 years are hardcore classes, and the second 2 years are clinical. So the hardest part for me was the hardcore basic science. Like, I had never had a formal biochemistry class. And there were 12 PhDs in biochemistry in my class, taking the same test I was. So, you know, it's like, holy smokes. The curve's like off the wall, and I'm just like... And I'm left-handed and Polish and stupid. And I mean, it's just, it was really miserable. It was a lot of work. A lot of PhDs in my class.
How did you get through all of that? Like, I mean, that motivation of going down south and helping people?
Yeah, because I had already been, I got my degree in nursing. I lived in Guatemala 6 months, but then before I went to Guatemala, I did work as a nurse for a couple years at the university. So I really knew what clinical medicine and surgery was. And so that's what kept me going.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it was everyday life for me.
So you were the chief of surgery at Fairview?
Yeah. That was an interesting year.
Why do you laugh about that?
So much pressure. I mean, there's all these situations that come up and belligerent abuse of doctors. I mean, surgeons are the worst. They're just like terrible.
Wait, so what?
So you got to discipline your colleagues and oh, cripe.
So is that the biggest difference when you get, I don't know, elevated to chief of surgery? Like what are the big things that you have to deal with
Discipline was the biggest thing.
Discipline?
Yeah, guys that are just acting out. And there being 3-year-olds in the operating room and stuff like that.
So, like...
That was the biggest thing. And then the second biggest thing was incompetence.
So, explain both of those a little more.
Oh, well, like somebody who yells at a nurse or swears at a nurse or throws an instrument in the operating room, you know, harassment. Or just plain old sexual harassment. So, that would be one thing. I mean, there's all kinds of tedious day-to-day stuff you got to do. Things you got to sign and blah, blah, blah. It's not that glorious or anything, but, you know, disciplining colleagues for abusive behavior or disciplining colleagues because they can't operate their way out of a wet paper bag and they don't realize they should have went into psychiatry and they shouldn't be in the operating room.
So essentially, you know, our target audience seems to be commonly it's the business professionals. I think a lot of them can relate to your position as chief of surgeon.
Because you got governance in corporate world.
Yeah. So how did you deal with the incompetence? In a sense, how did you address those conversations?
Well, I meet with the person with the surgery committee. And sometimes that took care of it. And sometimes it escalated to the point where it got all legal. And the way the bylaws of the hospital at Southdale read is you have a jury of 5 peers that judges the situation. That's like the end of the line. And then they either kick you off staff or you win the case and you keep being stupid.
Really? So what's the biggest difference between, for example, being at like running surgery and running your own practice? What made you?
Well, the practice is a business.
Yeah. So
surgery is healthcare administration.
So what made you make the change, number one, and what are the biggest things that you've learned from really starting your own practice and running it?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one, starting your own practice. I mean, you just see that it's a team. You know, we just have a family here. And, of course, then there's financial pressure and that kind of thing, too. And then marketing, you want to get patients in. And yeah, it's a big commitment.
So do you do all of that, or do you focus primarily just on the surgery?
No, well, I was just on with my office manager, but, you know, you've probably seen my staff. I mean, we've got like 9 people that work here. So I operated all morning, and then, you know, I mean, I'm signing contracts and leases and checks and so on, but I really try to divest myself as much of it for administration as I can and let the business run itself and my office managers run it.
Gotcha. So how does a private practice, I'm assuming that's what it is, right?
Yeah, totally. I'm down at the university. I'm a full clinical professor there.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. In the cleft lip and palate clinic, they call it the craniofacial clinic. It's in the School of Dentistry.
Really?
So I've been a professor there for a long time, like a full professor for a long time, probably 20 years. That's just, you know, a half a day or a little more than a half a day, and it's, you know, every month or a couple months, that kind of thing.
Oh.
So that's the academic side. And then I do a lot of speaking at meetings. And then I got, you know, the business and then taking care of patients.
So how do you balance all that?
No, yeah, I don't watch TV.
Respect.
Yeah. Plenty of time. So like next week I go to Dallas to teach in the cadaver lab for rhinoplasty. Then I fly from Dallas to Singapore to lecture, and then I fly from Singapore to Korea to do live surgery and lecture, and then fly home.
Wait, time out. So live surgery.
Yeah. I did live surgery last May in China. Oh, crap.
Live surgery, because I think very few of us know exactly what that is.
It's crazy. Well, it's where they film you doing an operation, and then it's projected to an auditorium with people watching you and record it. So they can learn your techniques.
Really?
Yeah, that's live surgery.
So, like, are you talking it through while you're doing live surgery?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they expect to be entertained. Yeah.
That seems so unnatural.
Yeah, it was really off balance. It was very difficult.
So you did it in China?
Yeah.
The first time?
Yeah.
And did you have an interpreter? Or did you not need one?
It was good. It was good because one of my buddies was also on the faculty for the big meeting. And he practices in New York. So we watched videos of me operating on the plane going there. So he knew exactly what we were going to be doing. And he was my assistant. My scrub nurse did not speak one word of English. So, you know, he was no help. And I just had my buddy grabbing the instruments and handing them to me, and that saved me. So, yeah, it's like, I don't want to do that again. That was no fun.
So do you practice something like that beforehand, or do you just do your normal surgery?
Because the surgery that I did, I'm sorry to interrupt you,
but no,
the surgery
good.
That I did, I've done thousands and thousands of that surgery. So it's like I could do it in my sleep, but assuming somebody can hand me the right instrument.
Maybe, actually, instead of going down that route, we'll actually go into our quickfire questions now that I know that you're a professor, which I did not know before this. No, which is interesting because a lot of our questions go back to the young professional.
Mm-hmm.
And so, number one, what skills do you believe a young professional needs to have straight out of college?
I think perseverance, meaning persistence, and humility.
So give them a little more context behind that. Why is humility so important, number one?
I think because it just alienates people when you're arrogant and don't listen and think you know it all. And I think that it helps team building and helps you get just, you know, a spoonful of honey kind of deal.
Hmm.
I think, and being humble helps you learn too. Be humble, play dumb, you know, and then you'll learn something instead of just being a know-it-all. I tend to be a little bit of a know-it-all. And my act is that I pretend I know it all, and then my other act is that I try to make people wrong, meaning I'm right. So if you temper that, then I think that's good. And then, of course, perseverance, persistence, drive. You know, you got to be a self-starter, and you just got to be absolutely unequivocally focused on what you're doing.
And what is persistence?
Never give up. You know, like when I took my entrance exam for med school, I got a couple of really low scores because I wasn't in the sciences. I wasn't getting my PhD in biochemistry. So I did crummy. So I studied all summer and got my scores up to snuff. Well, I wanted to give up when I got my scores back the first time. So that's what I mean by persistence. And, you know, it's the same thing with inventing and so on, you know. You got 20 iterations that don't work. Well, you can either give up or just keep charging ahead.
Yeah.
Like I did, I was testing a bunch of prototypes on Sunday for something and you know, I got up and I was like, oh, I don't want to work on this. And I don't want to. No, it's like, I got to. And I really sorted out 1, 2, 3, 4, the prototypes, which is not going to fly. And then in order of priority, the other three.
Good advice.
Mm-hmm.
Then real quick before I hop into quickfire number three, I need to ask, can you tell our audience about the surgical staple that you were kind of a part of the invented?
Well, that was an absorbable staple because I couldn't stand a sew. And they say, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. So I grabbed my brother-in-law, who's an engineer, and we were melting plastic, you know, surgical plastic polymers that other devices were made out of in my kitchen and working on that. We worked on that for a couple of years, and then I got a patent and on that and then brought in a couple other people and tried to pitch it to a number of companies, talk about persistence. So for 3 years, I tried to pitch it from my patent to a lot of companies. I got a cardboard box full of rejection letters. And then finally, we just did a PPM, which means a private placement memorandum to raise capital, start a company.
How much capital did you raise?
$3.4 million.
And then you guys kept running with it from there, did you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now it's on the market, and there's been a couple million used in patients. So that's pretty gratifying.
Yeah, for sure.
You can talk about a high.
It was one of the top medical devices.
Yeah.
At one point.
Right, I know. I used three of my staplers this morning during surgery. That was a kick.
Really?
Yeah, I love it. It saved me a lot of time, so.
That has to be super gratifying.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll get back into the quick fire. Number three, what do you believe needs to be sacrificed to be successful? What do you need to give up?
Give up being lazy.
And you really hit home on that, which I completely agree with. And what do you see as being lazy? And, you know, you brought up persistence.
You're like not a self-starter. There's nothing happening. You know, you got to generate it from within.
And like
that's what I see is if you're not self-motivated, you're lazy.
And see, I get that. Mm-hmm. And when people
two companies in college, I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir on that one.
No, but I think about and I see so many college students or early professionals. They believe this idea of persistence mm-hmm. and hard work and self-starter means that I go to work from 8 in the morning to 4 o'clock at night, hop on my video games, and then start over again because I'm doing my job, you know? And I'm very curious from your mind because you're so busy and you work so darn hard. Like, what does that look like to you? Like, when you say you need to be persistent, you can't be lazy, are you just talking about how many hours someone puts in or how they put in those hours?
Oh, yeah, you mean working smart rather than working hard. I don't know. I think you just got to put in the time because there's so much that takes time. Like to put together I'm going to have an hour and a half talk in Singapore. I mean, I can't tell you how many hours. And I talk to my friends how many hours they spend preparing their talks when we're on panels and stuff at meetings. And they spend like 20% of what I spend. And so they're just a lot better at it or something. But I mean, it's just hours and hours and hours. So you just, you know, just keep working.
Yeah.
But, you know, I exercise every day and I lift weights 3 times a week. And so I really got to, you know, I really balance it out.
Cool. And I don't want to take up too much more of your time. So we'll get to the last question. What is one life hack you believe young professionals could apply to their life this week?
Eat right.
Eat right.
Yeah.
And
eat healthy so you don't get Alzheimer's or fall down and break your hip or all, you know, have a heart attack in your 50s or if you really wanted to hack life, I'd just be healthy
and
eat right and exercise.
And so what is something they could do this week? What should they eat? Number one, and how long should they exercise?
You don't want to know. I'd go vegan and
really
you go to nutritionfacts.org. You'll get 1,000 reviews on multiple thousands and thousands of articles on why it's a better lifestyle. What's the people group in America that lives the longest?
I have no idea.
Seventh-day Adventist. And they're all vegan or vegetarian. So it's like, well, I don't want to get old and be demented and so on. So I don't know. I would just start eating right. I wish I would have when I was younger. So if you look at that, you might say, I don't care. I don't care if I live longer. I just want to eat pizza. It's okay. You know, with sausage on it. But I don't know. That's kind of a hard question to answer. So that's just the thing that came to my mind. If you really wanted to hack life.
Oh, I like
that.
I know
that's probably not what you're looking for.
No, I am, actually.
There's so many podcasts. Peter Attia is a longevity physician in New York, A-T-T-I-A. He's got a free podcast. Michael Greger, nutritionfacts.org. He's like completely vegan. And I mean, there's good studies that show this is a good way to live. And then exercise, you know, it depends how big you are into weightlifting.
Mm-hmm.
I would lift 3 times a week and then maybe a little bit different muscle groups every morning when you get up and then, you know, just something aerobic every day.
That's awesome.
But that's how I got through med school because the dean, the very first day of class, the dean of the med school came in and he says, I want to tell you guys 3 things. He said, number one, realize that medical school is like taking a drink out of a fire hydrant. You're going to get a lot more than you bargained for. And we were carrying 27 credits, and a lot of those were lab credits. Those were real credits. That was a real load of classes. And college is what, 15 or 16?
16.
Yeah, 16. So we're all doing 16 in college, and suddenly we're doing 27 with labs. And then he said, the second thing is, if you're treed by a bear, enjoy the view, which I think he's meaning, you know, when things are down, be optimistic. Look at the bright side. That's what I got out of it. And the third thing is, he says, you take 1 hour every day and you do something diversional. Because he said, 50% of you are going to need professional counseling through your med school years because of psychological problems. And so I just went out and started riding my bike every day for an hour. But basically, I'd ride to school and ride home, and that was my hour. So that's, I just think it's a really healthy thing to do in terms of hacking life.
For sure.
Those were his kind of three hacks.
I love them. And yeah. I think that's actually a good way to end the podcast. So mm-hmm. I really appreciate your time. And I know you're super busy, so it means a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Hey everyone, Bobby, your host, back with you. Some reminders from this podcast before I let you go and enjoy the rest of your week. Number one, as Dr. Joe said, you will need perseverance to succeed. It's going to be an uphill battle. Nevertheless, enjoy it all. He had a very great phrase when talking about perseverance. Here it is. When a bear chases you up a tree, enjoy the view. Pretty simple, but remember that this week. Number two, this week, focus on your eating habits. Try to eat healthier to maximize your life. Set aside some time this week to think about how you can make changes that will better your future. So important. And before I let you go, please don't hesitate to reach out to the Master of the Start crew. We have a few interns working on social media. Check us out at Master of the Start on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. If you have any guests that you'd like to have on the show, reach out. We'll try to get them booked. And we'll have some very interesting podcasts in the future. Little sneak peek for you. We have Ozzie Nelson on the show next week, and it is one of my favorite podcast episodes. We'll see you next week.